Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the Geek Show's dedicated podcast to...
it's not about anything, listeners. We're just very dedicated to the podcast.
Yes, we are. We're dedicated. And
it's an art form.
It is an art form. Also a book form. Maybe a music form. We're not sure.
A form of an ice dragon.
Yes. Anyway, my name's Rob, and joining me today, as you can hear, are Andrew.
Hello.
And also, Graham is back to keep us in line.
Hi there.
We're not saying Graham has any dictatorial qualities to him, but that's exactly what we're saying.
Also, more importantly, Graham is the one we make do all the looking for stories and stuff.
Yes.
It is quite frightening that you're relying on me to keep you in line. That's not a position I've ever been in before.
I think maybe that explains the entire concept of this show.
Yes. So, anyway, shall we move on without further ado?
Yes, I think so.
I think we really need to get its own theme tune, or whatever the theme tune is.
I think you'll find I gave us our own theme tune last time.
Go on then.
You're the one who didn't like it.
Go on then. That can be the official theme tune.
Do
no, we're doing the whole thing, Graham. Shut up.
Yes. And in true fashion, I don't know how we managed to do this, I don't know how this happens, but George R. R. Martin is doing other things again, aside from writing The Winds of Bloody Winter.
How did he do so much yet so little?
I don't know. He had one job. Apparently, HBO has given a pilot order to a series set thousands of years before Game of Thrones, with the screenwriter for Kick-Ass and Kingsman, Jane Goldman, as the showrunner, and also George R.R. Martin is going to be working on it as well.
It's set thousands of years before, but it will air thousands of years after.
Yes, when the New Mutants comes out. It's going to chronicle the world's descent from the golden age of heroes into its darkest hour.
Hmm.
So. Okay.
It's quite a long hour, isn't it? Considering that this is set thousands of years before the events of Game of Thrones.
It reminds me of an old Lenny Henry joke from his stage show, where he's talking about death, and death holds up a big egg timer, says, "Your time is up." He's like, "That's a long 4 minutes. I'd hate to eat one of your boiled eggs."
I don't know. I think that fits in with Game of Thrones' whole thing of summer can last for years, winter a lifetime, an hour even longer than it takes George R. R. Martin to type a paragraph.
So, does
but I don't mean type out, you know, enough words to fill out a paragraph. I mean to type the words a paragraph.
I am beginning to wonder if he's done a bit too much geology, so his thinking has switched to geological time.
Maybe.
Because geologists don't measure things in like minutes and hours, which is why they're always late. I know this because there used to be one.
Right.
You start thinking like in thousands of years, in millions of years, and you start going, yeah, I'll be fine. Time is all relative.
So, well,
what do you mean the book's running late? The Eurasian plate hasn't even crashed into North America yet.
That's what I'm thinking. Is he thinking like that?
Martin's contract promises that he will deliver the book within the current epoch.
Or maybe it is, you'll have the Winds of Winter before we resurrect actual dinosaurs. Don't worry.
I remember when the first Jurassic Park movie came out, and there were quite a lot of stories in the press about, is it possible? Could we resurrect dinosaurs? And I just kept thinking, I feel like the Jurassic Park film franchise makes a pretty good counter-argument as to why we shouldn't.
Yeah, I think the better counter-argument was from the guys who actually know their science and just very quietly over in the corner just pointed out, Yeah, no, and it lasts for about 500 years. You do know this.
Yes.
So, actually, there's a theory about Jurassic Park that I really like.
Oh.
That I think makes that film make even a small modicum of sense. It's the idea that, of course, John Hammond can't bring dinosaurs back. That's ridiculous. But he can make his own creatures.
Yeah.
See, I like that.
Yeah, plus that makes sense as to why, like, Alan Grant is invited to the island in the first place.
Mm.
Basically, you know, if you can trick an actual fossil man, I forget the archaeologist.
No, not archaeologist. It's not an archaeologist. That's Indiana Jones. Or are you now saying that every single temple and pyramid is a dinosaur?
Could be.
Because that would just be the most awesome profession then. Paleontologists.
I mean, they're not. They're Transformers, the ones who fought the Deceptor dinos.
Yes. Paleontologists is what you mean.
Dinosaurs. Tyrannobots, I like that.
I like that we all just paused to get Andrew to squeeze out that joke.
Yes. We're so considerate.
Yeah, well, they've actually embraced that in the new films, haven't they? They have genetically modified fictional dinosaurs so that they can sell copyrighted toys of those. To make the park even more exciting and dangerous.
Is that because they couldn't copyright a T-Rex?
Basically, yes.
I mean, at this point, I'm pretty sure that entire franchise is just a middle finger to me personally. Because, like, you'll make your own goddamn dinosaurs before you just give me a Stegosaurus. And not some punk-ass guy in the back of the scene who looks a bit platey. No. Want my big stabby tail boy front and centre just wrecking houses and taking names.
Dinosaurs are brilliant, aren't they? We don't talk about dinosaurs enough on this show.
When I was at uni in the 90s, I liked dinosaurs so much I left engineering for it.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's the absolute truth. I was started off in mechanical engineering, and after 1 year I got bored, looked around, saw there was a geology department, and I thought, they do dinosaurs.
Oh, Vikes, I thought you were talking about that mad passionate affair you had with a brachiosaur.
No, that came afterwards.
I have exciting news, everyone.
Oh?
Yes.
This tangent has gone on for so long. Gil Martin still hasn't finished Winds of Winter.
He killed my punchline about how I'm still banned from the Natural History Museum.
And appropriately, you dug it up anyway.
Yeah, I did, because that's what geologists do.
Well, that was good work, guys. That ended up having nothing at all to do with George R. R. Martin.
Yes. Anyway, shall we move on?
Ideally.
Yeah, I had things I wanted to say, but it's not worth it.
We talked about this, I think, on the last show. Self-published author Felina Hopkins has been trying to assert her right to copyright a particular word, and she has been told by a judge that her attempts to stop other authors using this particular word is weak, and she has lost her case. And what she's been trying to do, this is a self-published author, I should remind you that, okay, that's a very important point. She's self-published, so she's basically representing herself, right?
Yeah.
She doesn't have any publishers behind her or anything like that. And she's up against a variety of authors, including some very, very published authors, who are a lot more well-known than she is. And she, if I remember rightly, her books were like The Cocky Cowboy and The Cocky Barman or whatever it is, and it's all about the Cocky Brothers. I think or was it the Cocker Brothers or something like that?
I want to say Cocker Brothers.
Yes. It's called She applied for a preliminary injunction and a temporary restraining order to prevent the publication of a collection of stories by various authors called Cocktails, The Cocky Collective, which was written as an act of protest against Hopkins' trademark.
The Cocky Collective.
Yeah, she was trying to trademark the word cocky. And
they're my favourite early 90s new wave group.
Urban Cocky Collective. Oh, that's a joke for the old ravers in the audience. We must have some.
Yeah,
I'm not sure we have an audience.
It would explain a lot.
Yeah, her lawsuit was filed against Tara Crescent, who's the author of another book series that used the word cocky. Because of this, the Authors Guild and the Romance Writers of America joined forces to provide Tara Crescent with legal assistance and defend the principle that no one should be able to own exclusive rights to use a common word, which is exactly right and proper. Looking at you, Facebook, who tried to trademark the words face and book.
I didn't know that. Yeah,
they failed catastrophically because the judge looked at Mark Zuckerberg's face and said, "You want to trademark the word face?"
Did he then throw the book at his face?
I hope so.
Oh dear! I remember when Taylor Swift tried to trademark the phrase "this sick beat."
I mean, see, that doesn't work on two levels because A, that's not a term you can copyright. And B, there's plenty of demonstrable evidence that she does not know what a sick beat is.
Yes. Yeah, that was my counter-argument, that obviously the sick beat-making skills of Taylor Swift can clearly stand without getting the law involved. I mean, when most people think of the sweet throb of an 808, Taylor Swift's early country career is exactly what they think of.
Doesn't she say that line in one song, that Shake It Off? But yeah. Then right after that sick beat bit, she goes into some kind of kid's nursery rhyme. Is that the sick beat that she's on about?
I think it is, yes.
Is the sick beat like ring a ring of roses, a pocket full of posies?
The sick beat's like she's trying out for the high school cheerleading squad. Yeah, it's not exactly Run DMC, is it?
Does she mean sick beat in the sense of, help, this song is incredibly ill? It needs urgent aid. Or possibly just to be put down.
Oh, God, now I've got Taylor Swift with just like a musical note going, just $3 a month can help save this musical. This sick beat.
It's making me want Taylor Swift to present Animal Hospital. I mean, someone's got to. Now that Rolf Harris has been involved in all the unpleasantness, I just want to see her, like, stroking a kangaroo's head, talking about him being a brave little trooper.
We've done it again. And this is on a story about Felina Hopkins not being able to trademark the word cocky. How have we got away from that?
It's not like it isn't ridiculous enough, I agree.
And I love it when people try and copyright common words.
Yes, it's always funny.
It just boggles the mind that anybody would actually make the attempt.
Yeah.
So you want to copyright the word elbow?
Yeah, that was Guy Garvey went mad with power that day. Didn't you mention on the last show that the Fine Brothers tried to trademark
the word react?
Yeah,
reaction videos. Like they had this whole thing going where if you want to make a reaction video, like you pay them for the rights to create this format that they didn't invent, and there's also just people going, this trailer, whoa!
Yeah.
I heard it was even further than that, and if you had a reaction to anything, up to and including the Fine Brothers trademarking the word react, you had to pay the Fine Brothers before you could react to it.
Yeah, I've got to admit, Dad dying of his horrific peanut allergy was a real blow, but it was nothing compared to the fine we had to pay to the Fine Brothers. That's what the name meant all along.
Yeah. I actually just found an interesting little list for you guys.
Okay, but no, shush. You're not going to take this from me. I've been trying to circle around to this.
Okay.
We have done a disservice by not even getting to this point yet. So, yeah. Rob, Graham, Would you say that Felina Hopkins has been cock-blocked?
Massively worth it.
Yes.
What's this list you found, Rob?
I found two lists, apparently, of common words that are actually trademarked. But they're trademarked because they've become common words after the fact. So they were this thing first, and then they became common words afterwards.
Yeah.
It's like how in the UK, glass is also a verb.
Yes. Kind of a dark example, but I'll allow it.
Bubble wrap, for example, we know it's bubble wrap. That's a nice, easy one. Jet ski is another nice, easy one. Crockpot, another nice, easy one. But things like popsicle, Velcro, Band-Aid, they're all easy. Google, we know it's the most famous example. Google was Google first, and then, you know, we actually use it as a verb now, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay, so these are all like the name of brands that have now just become like synonymous with the thing they're doing.
Yeah. Rollerblade. Like
Hoover. Hoover is the classic one, yeah.
Hoover. Superhero.
Which monster uses superhero as a verb?
It was trademarked in 1967 by DC Comics and Marvel.
No way.
Yep.
That's insane.
Yep, but the thing is, the superhero term that they trademarked were super and hero together to say superhero. The generic term is superhero, all one word.
That's...
Yep.
Wait, so they trademarked superhero, but not the way you spell superhero.
Yep. A onesie. Onesie is actually a trademarked word.
That I can sort of see.
So, yeah, there's stuff like shabby chic is actually trademarked.
I completely support any restriction on people using the phrase shabby chic.
Anything Disney is trademarked.
Yeah.
There are a couple, though, that I don't recognise at all. Things like taggies and koozie.
Wow, koozie. Can think of things it could mean, but I'm not sure I can say them on this podcast.
Well, I
assumed it was just a particularly adorable machine gun.
I was surprised to find out that it is a thing that goes around a can to keep it cool.
Right.
So it's a thing that wraps around a cylinder for a purpose.
Like, so my hand is a koozie.
Apparently. I don't want to know what cylinder, though.
Oh, dear.
Shall we move on, Graham? I think it's your turn to take over.
Yeah, please move it off this topic.
Because he's got the whole world in his koozies. He's got the whole world in his koozies. What is the world anymore?
Given this level of mania, it would seem surprising that there were no funny novels being written, wouldn't it?
Yes, that is a surprise, as we've apparently learned.
Yes, because the Wodehouse Prize, which we have covered before, they were the people who gave Helen Fielding a pig.
Yep.
They are taking a year off because they simply said... none of the 62 novels they received for shortlisting were funny enough to win the award.
Wow.
It's quite harsh, isn't it?
That is very harsh.
Oh my, and 62 novels.
Yeah.
That's 62 authors who've just been dissed.
They have promised a rollover prize for next year, which will be a bigger pig.
Oh, why not just make it two pigs? Let's go the whole hog.
I see what you did.
Rob.
I was one of those where I didn't actually realise what I was saying until I said it.
Very impressive stuff, though. So, yeah, this is quite unfortunate. And Sam Leith has written an article for The Guardian talking about how we define the comic novel and pointing out that a lot of quote-unquote serious authors, he mentions the late Philip Roth, are very funny, which I would agree with. I mean, I've probably laughed at Thomas Pynchon more than I've laughed at several actual working comedians, but he's not classed as a comic novelist. He's too clever.
Wow.
That is it, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is basically snobbery.
Yeah, breaking news. People who specialise in one particular field or genre are actually a bit snobby about it.
Yes.
Unless they're car mechanics.
Yeah, that's true. They're pleased. I say they're unpretentious, but I don't know enough car mechanics. You know, they could all just sort of kick back after work with some Philip Glass and read Michael Houellebecq.
I don't know why we keep saying that I'm the middle class one.
Oh, no, we know Graham's middle class. You know, we absolutely know that Graham's middle class.
I've had tea with a vicar.
Yeah.
But he does, I mean, some of the novels that he cites as good comic novels by quote-unquote serious novelists do make me realise why literary critics hold the form in such disdain. I mean, he mentions Solar by Ian McEwan, which reads like the work of a robot that has had the concept of humour programmed into it.
Oh, God, that's just reminding me of... There's a character I encountered in my journeys through anime who has the most robotic laugh I've ever heard on any character. The laugh is basically, ah.
That's almost certainly how Ian McEwan laughs, isn't yes. it?
I mean, having read Atonement, I can confirm Ian McEwan definitely does not know what a smile is. I think he's probably got a whole novel about how horrified he was by seeing someone's strange, like, rictus mouth position.
It's like their face cracked open and then went up. What even is it?
Oh, I'm going to shock you both by introducing football into this mix, right?
Oh.
Yep. Have you seen what they're doing over in Russia for the World Cup? They've got just normal, average, everyday people and they're teaching them how to laugh and smile.
No way.
Seriously?
You see, literary critics always say that in Russia, Chekhov's considered an incredible wit. You know, his plays are considered very funny, and they always use this to make the point that the plays are not well translated. It might just be that Chekhov is as funny in Russian as it is in English, and it's just the case that by the standards of Russia, the Cherry Orchard is quite funny.
Yeah, but can he pilot a starship?
In Soviet Russia, gun shoots you in the third act. I'm mainly just disappointed that the reason the Roadhouse Prize is taking a year off is not because like the head judge is taking a vacation in the country, but has had to stay longer because the young man engaged to his cousin has been caught in some kind of compromising situation. And now he has to concoct an like, elaborate plan to explain how it was all just, you know, a terrible misunderstanding. But of course the plan is going to go awry and make the situation even more convoluted.
There's a great Mitchell and Webb sketch which not enough people know, largely because it was cut from the episode, but I think it is on one of the DVDs. Where David Mitchell plays a playwright who writes what he thinks are harrowing plays about the dissolution of his marriage and his wife's infidelity. But they're all like really broad farces, like Brian Rick's style bedroom farces. And it just cuts from scenes from them to him sobbing, saying, I mean, what is funny about being locked out of your honeymoon suite in your underpants while your wife has sex with a man in a suit of armour?
Oh.
That sounds incredible.
Yes. I can't think of a segue to any single thing that we've got on the dais here. So should we just talk about the Golden Booker?
Yes.
Because it's fun to say Golden Booker, isn't it?
See,
certainly is.
See, you said the Golden Booker, and now I'm just imagining a thing where Eddie Murphy has to go across the world. You know, and end up in the mountains of Nepal and Tibet and just rescue this Golden Booker from the forces of evil.
I now want to write a Booker Prize-winning novelization of The Golden Child. I'm pretty sure it must be possible.
Oh, that's... Now I get it.
It's a bit weird, I've got to admit, even by our own standards, but that's the connection he was making.
Yes. And it has such classic lines as, "Brother Numsy has forgiven me."
So anyway, the Golden Booker.
Yes. The Golden Booker has taken a single title from each decade that the Booker Prize has been going, which gives it a shortlist of five. The one representing the 2010s is Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. The one representing the 2000s is Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel. The 1990s are represented by The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje. The 1980s by Moon Tiger by Penelope Lively. And the 1970s by In a Free State by V.S. Naipaul. Some eyebrows raised about the choice of Moon Tiger, largely because when the Booker Prize did the Booker of Bookers competition, which we'll say that 10 times fast and still come out with a clean rating on Apple Podcasts, it was won by Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, which was published in 1981, and yet that is not their 80s representative.
I'm surprised by that, because Midnight's Children is a great book.
Yeah.
Also, what's the difference between a Golden Booker and a Booker of Bookers? That's too many bookers. Oh, that's another one. See, I already don't like this story.
See, you're saying Booker, but the more you say Booker, the more it sounds like Booger.
Yes.
As in, thing that comes out your nose, not the other thing.
Oh, right, yeah. Of course, that's what I was thinking of. yeah, there isn't really any difference, and even Robert McCrum, who is one of the judges, has said this is a stunt.
I mean, fair enough, at least they're honest about it.
Yes.
I mean, is the Golden Booker like a book in gold, or is it strangely shaped like a guy just standing still?
Like a booger?
No, no, no. Well, actually, the Oscar does kind of look like a booger.
It doesn't, tragically, this article does not say. I really want to know whether the Golden Booker is a golden book.
See, I want it to be a golden helmet that they have to wear on every public speaking occasion.
Yes, I want to see Hilary Mantel in full, like, Wagnerian Valkyrie costume.
Yes.
Who wouldn't enjoy that except Hilary Mantel, probably?
Well, I don't know, the male authors might not. They have to go around dressed like a Valkyrie.
Well, I think V.S. Naipaul would look lovely in a big gold bra.
Or maybe they get to choose, you know, the Valkyrie costume, so they want to look like Valkyrie from Thor Ragnarok.
Yes.
Actually, maybe that's why Salman Rushdie isn't included in the shortlist. Because he's actually going to burst into the end singing, "Kill the Wabbit, kill the Wabbit."
What an image.
Look, I'll admit that's all I know about opera.
Yes, me too. That's a pretty good list, though, isn't it? I'm unswayed by Saunders, and maybe, I don't know any Penelope Lively, so I can't say if Moon Tiger, which I assume is part of the Marvel Moon Knight franchise, is worthy of beating Rushdie, Kazuo Ishiguro, Bruce Chatwin, and all those other great 80s novelists. But, you know, Mantel, Ondaatje, Naipaul, good stuff. Yeah.
I really want a superhero called Moon Tiger now.
It would be rad.
Well, we do have Moon Dragon, so Moon Tiger is kind of a natural offshoot of that, isn't it?
I mean, no, but I get what you're trying to do. Oh, Mix.
Are you actually looking to see if there's one called Moon Tiger?
Look, there's a character called Angar the Screamer. Moon Tiger is not out of the realm of possibility.
This is true. This is very true. And the reason why I said Moon Dragon, Moon Tiger, is because the Chinese have their dragon and tiger thing, don't they?
Sorry, I'm not going to allow us to just march past Angar the Screamer without further discussion. How was that suggested? Did anyone just say to the writer, look, what he does in his personal life is none of our business?
Oh, if I remember rightly from the from what we found about Angar the Screamer, wasn't he a former hippie who just got really angry and shouted at people? That was his superpower.
Yes.
He's like the Incredible Hulk, but without the Hulk.
But he does have an incredibly 70s porn stash.
Oh,
by
nice.
Which I mean a mustache, not a... I don't realise like the other way that could be interpreted as I was saying it.
I'm looking at a picture of him now, and yeah, he looks like he might have been vaguely cool back in the 70s, but if he was a real person, he would absolutely be a Trump voter now.
Oh, he would, wouldn't he?
I'm glad he's dead. There, I said it.
Oh, so is there a Moon Tiger?
No, not that I could find.
There's a new comic book character for us to create, then.
Yeah, and we could win a Booker for it, if they get confused.
It's got the word Book in it.
Let's get on the short list.
Yeah. Shall we move on?
Let's move on. This. Have you ever read Nancy Drew and thought, this isn't intersectional enough?
Well, I think you need to just start that again and just say, have you ever read Nancy Drew?
Yeah, fair enough. I am more familiar with it as a thing Americans always go on about rather than something I have read.
Yeah, because, I mean, there was the Hardy Boys and the Nancy Drew stuff, but I'll be honest, I wasn't a big fan of either. I read a lot of Three Investigators stuff.
I don't know that one. What was that?
It was the one that was kind of produced by Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, right.
And I preferred it because it had Hitchcock's name on it, so.
Nice.
I feel like I've read a lot of stuff that's been inspired by, like, the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, but never, like, any of those stories.
Yeah, I'd go with that. Well, the franchise is being updated in the new Nancy Drew mystery stories, a series of new mystery stories about Nancy Drew.
I never would have guessed that from what you said.
Yes, but let me just see if I can find the author's name.
Please let the author be called Mr. E.
Yes. It doesn't actually list who's writing them, but the illustrator of it, Jensen Tong, has outed the character George. Now, as any readers of Enid Blyton will know, there's got to be a woman called George in a children's mystery series, and it is also a dead certainty that they will be gay.
Okay.
I mean, everyone thought that about George from the Famous Five, right?
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah, part of it is just making the subtext text, but I'm looking at the illustrations that have been put... it's a comic book. I didn't realise that. It's going to be a comic book series. It's very well illustrated, and the characters in it do not look like I imagine Nancy Drew characters to be. I've always imagined it as a, let's face it, very white, very 50s world. And this is seriously diverse. So, on the one hand, it's very exciting. On the other hand, every time something like this happens, I'm sort of half looking forward to it and half thinking, oh God, I'll have to read people on the internet wanging on about how it ruined their childhood for years afterwards.
Okay, so where does the intersectional bit come in?
Just in terms of the fact that it has queer characters, it has non-white characters.
Okay, because I was looking at the word intersectional quite literally. I was thinking, so is it in sections? And how?
Right.
Do you see what I mean? I thought they were doing some new storytelling methodology or something like that.
No, it's just my earnest liberal white guy buzzwords baffling the hell out of everyone again.
Right. Okay, that explains a lot.
You know, I've got to be. I didn't think of myself being that liberal, but I think I've decided after all the horrible, horrible stuff with Kelly Marie Tran.
Oh God, yeah.
I've come up with a new personal mantra. Make all of it gay.
Yes.
Everything. All the characters, they're all gay. They're all from multicultural backgrounds. Just make so much diversity that all like the awful internet troll crybabies just literally their hearts explode.
God, I'm fully on board with this.
That would have been a hell of a campaign for Trump. Make America gay again.
I thought Solo would have been a much better film if Emilia Clarke and Tandy Newton had swapped roles, partly because I think Tandy Newton is brill and there is not enough of her in the film, but also that having Han's love interest be like a black woman in her 40s would upset the kind of Star Wars fans who don't deserve to enjoy Star Wars.
See, you're saying that, but it's Han Solo, and I'll be honest, that guy would just... he'd go with anybody he was attracted to.
Of course he would.
Man, woman, Wookiee, doesn't matter.
Well, the sheer heat of the relationship between him and Chewbacca, I think, overshadows the actual love story in Solo.
Yeah. I mean, they are basically like a married couple, though, aren't they?
Completely, yeah.
I'm putting it... Ron, I know you listen to the show. Solo 2... it begins with Han, Lando, and Chewie just all waking up in bed together.
Also, if human civilization is any guide, probably the first thing we're going to do once we find intelligent life in the universe is think, can I bang it?
See, I know that you tried to make a joke there, but I reckon that's the case as well.
It's true, yeah.
Well... We react to new things in four ways. Can I bang it? Can I kill it? Can I feed it? And can I sell it stuff?
Yes. Yeah, it's very true.
And have you noticed how none of those are, can I make friends with it?
No. I suppose the first one, you know, it's...
You're making special friends with them.
You've got to buy him a drink first, right?
See, you say that, but given human history...
Yeah, and I mean, it's another planet. Buying someone a drink might be a grievous insult to their family and honour.
Well, never mind that. I mean, given human history with a certain continent, I should say.
Yeah, I'm trying not to make it depressing, and you're making it depressing.
I'm hoping we can move on from this, because I've got no more jokes.
I have one last...
I mean, some would say you didn't even really have one joke to begin with.
I have one last thing from intersectional Nancy Drew from this story before we move on. The extraordinary sentence, it comes soon after a similar reimagining of Louisa May Alcott's 1868 novel Little Women, with the March sisters now recast as multiracial and LGBTQ inclusive to mark the novel's 150th anniversary. I mean, nice idea, but a book that is literally called Little Women can only be so inclusive, right?
Yes. I mean, once you go past a certain point, it's no longer Little Women. I've read Little Women, and I do like the book, but there's not much room to manoeuvre in there.
That you couldn't sort of write one of the Alcott sisters as, say, a big man.
No, you
they're
couldn't.
Actually
oh, couldn't
women.
You? That's the twist.
Although I would actually love to see a kind of Pivendello-esque, you know, six characters in search of an author book about a group of gender non-conforming, non-binary trans women who are hacked off that they're in a book called Little Women. It's like, is the author even listening to us here?
Possibly.
I might write it.
I think you should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because remember, Grim, every time you write an all-inclusive story, somewhere an internet troll, they explode.
Yes. I just want the line in Little Women now. Nobody would ever mention Josephine's beard.
It sounds like a good book that... get ready for the smoothness of this segue. No one would ever leave behind in a hotel.
Oh.
Whoa! We're in another story! I didn't even realise.
It's not my most robust work.
I think the fact that you telegraphed it as a segue is what killed it.
No, I think the fact that it's rubbish is what killed it, but thank you for sparing my feelings.
I'm being nice today. It won't last long.
Yes, Alex Johnson in The Independent has compiled a list of the titles most commonly left at travel lodges.
Just at travel lodges?
Well, there is another list later on which we'll get to, but for the moment, let's just talk about travel lodges. Shall I give you the top 20?
Go on.
Right. Number one is 50 Shades Freed.
No surprise.
Number two is Bared to You by Sylvia Day.
Okay.
Which is kind of one of those erotic bestsellers that came out in the wake of 50 Shades.
Okay, so basically 20 and 19, you know, they might as well have just gone out and bought porn.
Oh, sorry, those are one and two. Those are one and two?
Okay, so the top two are basically, they could have just gone and bought porn.
Essentially, yes, yeah. Three is a book I'm not familiar with, I must say. It's The Marriage Bargain by Jennifer Probst.
That sounds like a book that we're not familiar with for a fairly good reason.
Yes. Number four is Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn.
Okay.
Number five is The Casual Vacancy by J.K. Rowling.
Oh, God.
Yep.
See, that's the one I was going to say was a bit harsh. I don't mind The Casual Vacancy. It's not as popular among you guys.
So you didn't mind The Casual Racism in The Casual Vacancy?
I don't remember The Casual Racism in The Casual Vacancy.
That was what it got heavily criticised for.
I genuinely did not notice. I will have to read it less casually next time.
I'm just not a fan of the casual bad writing.
Number six is another one from best-selling erotic author E.L. Wistie. It's 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, good. And that's good, because obviously after reading 50 Shades Freed, the one thought on everyone's mind is, but how can I go back to where this all began?
Yes. It's also, if you went into a hotel and there was an abandoned copy of 50 Shades of Grey on the mattress, you'd ask for that bed to be thoroughly cleaned.
No, I'd ask for a new bed.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go anywhere near it. I'd ask for a new bed. No, in fact, I'd ask for a new room.
I mean, a new hotel.
Yeah, I was scaling up to that.
As E.L. Wistie goes, so Sylvia Day must follow. Her book Reflected in You is at number seven.
I'm guessing it's a book all about mirrors.
But like sexy mirrors.
Yes.
That's the latest thing. Sexy vampires are yesterday. Sexy mirrors are where it's at.
Yeah, because sexy vampires have no reflection, so, you know.
Yeah, they're in conflict. We're basically writing this ourselves, aren't we?
Yeah, vampires versus mirrors. It's the war to end all wars.
Just because it's so even-sided, because, like, the mirrors, they can't see the vampires, but also they can reflect the sunlight at the vampires.
Yep.
Wow. This is good.
It is. And against that backdrop, one young vampire will fall in love with a mirror.
Much like Piers Morgan.
Oh, it's because the mirror reflects his true soul, which is empty.
Oh, that's so bad. It could be a real Stephanie Meyer line.
I know.
At number eight, there's a bit of a surprise. A book that nobody could possibly twang it to. It's My Time by Bradley Wiggins.
Okay.
Is that just Bradley Wiggins confused by the concept of clocks?
Maybe that's why they're leaving it behind. They hate his arrogance in saying that, you know, he can own time. You're not Doctor Who, Bradley Wiggins.
Or maybe it's just that time he actually went shopping for a watch.
Maybe. Yes.
Which was an exciting experience. Because he was already high on his definitely medically recommended asthma medication, which is completely no relation to the coincidence that he's like the greatest cyclist ever. I have strong opinions on Bradley Wiggins, and those opinions aren't good ones.
At number nine, try and contain your surprise, it's Sylvia Day again with Entwined With You.
I'm guessing this is all about knitting and sewing and roping.
It's about her trip to see the world's biggest ball of twine, which I think is in Minnesota.
Of course. The sexiest backdrop.
Number 10, again, where day comes, so to speak, Wistie will follow. It's 50 Shades Darker by E.L. Wistie.
Oh, well, thank goodness. We've got the whole trilogy.
Yeah, you can collect the set if you go to enough travel lodges.
Or charity shops.
You just imagine if you read 50 Shades Freed and then you went back and read 50 Shades of Grey, but you couldn't get the middle part of that trilogy. You'd be missing out on all that. Something that probably happens.
You'd be missing out on the Vandermas helicopter crash, which literally does not affect anyone at all. Seriously, Christine.
I'm sorry, is that an actual thing that happens in the books?
Yeah, Christine Grey just sort of walks away from a helicopter crash. He's like this incredibly famous billionaire. He goes off, he crashes his helicopter, and nobody really notices, and it doesn't seem to hurt him.
How do you know this, Graham?
I have a friend whose wife is worryingly into 50 Shades of Grey.
Ah, a friend whose wife is worryingly into 50 Shades of Grey.
And also, I love them, but I assume you knew that, and I didn't need to mention it. Number 11, It's My Story by Cheryl Cole.
Great.
Yes. And number 12, it's The Marriage Trap by Jennifer Probst.
That's the best-selling author of The Marriage Bargain.
It certainly is. I'm glad you know her, Andrew.
Is this a trilogy on marriage or something?
Oh, wait till you hear the title of number 3. That's coming up later.
Oh, okay.
At 13, it's Camp David by David Walliams.
Okay.
That's like some kind of Being John Malkovich scenario.
At number 14, it's Call the Midwife, a true story of the East End in the 1950s by Jennifer Wirth.
I'm tired of all these true stories of the East End in the 1950s. I want true stories of the Northeast in the 1950s.
Yes. That's it.
No one had any money and it was a bit peaky out. There you go. That's your true story.
That's we still wore t-shirts.
That will literally be it, won't it?
Number 15 is Before I Go to Sleep by S.J. Watson, which, based on the title, seems like quite an appropriate thing to read in a hotel.
I just want S.J. to stand for social justice.
S.J. Watson is literally an S.J.W. How would I not notice this before?
Chapter 1, Before I Go to Sleep, I Crushed the Patriarchy.
Oh, is that what it is then? Just a list of things that S.J. Watson has done before?
Going to sleep, yeah. Before I Go to Sleep, I find a children's cartoon from the 80s and say it should have more black characters in. And then I go to sleep happily, thinking of all of the very sensible and proportionate responses that comment will surely get.
I mean, to be fair, it's not like they said it should have a new animation style.
Please
yeah,
don't.
That's weird, isn't it, how that's gone over.
Please don't. You're just reminding me of Thundercats Roar now, and I'm sad.
It's a cartoon for children, Rob. Get over it.
It was a cartoon for my childhood.
And do you know what, Rob? Do you know what?
What?
It was crap.
I never said it was brilliant.
All of them were bad. Thundercats was bad. He-Man was bad. Heck, Transformers was bad. There, I said it.
And how much of you has died inside now?
A lot, but it's necessary. Every Transformers cartoon that has come after it has been better. Just by pure value of them not reusing the same, like, 3 frames of animation over and over and over.
Search your hearts, listeners. You know he's right.
It's the same road. They're always driving on the same road.
Well, 16, we're about to find out the thrilling conclusion to the Jennifer Probst marriage trilogy.
Oh?
It's The Marriage Mistake.
The Marriage Mistake?
She took
a true tell-all of writing the first two books.
She took three books to work out that it was a mistake.
So, Ian, I've got to ask, is she also the award-winning author of the Parent Trilogy, which started off The Parent Bargain, which comes after The Marriage Mistake, and then it goes on to The Parent Trap?
The Parent Trap sounds like what caused the marriage mistake.
And The Parent Mistake is where they've grown up to be teenagers. The parents are like, no. And, you know, Disney made that film called The Parent Trap.
Straight twice.
Yeah.
I was very excited about 17, but now I've just read what the actual title is.
Yeah, I was going to say 17 is The Racketeer by John Grisham.
Yeah, which, that's an A, not an O.
Yeah, I did assume it was just John Grisham's Rocketeer fanfic, which, let's face it, would qualify as the best thing he ever wrote.
Actually, it would, does sound good.
18 is The Carrier by Sophie Hannah, which I haven't heard of, but I assume it's about her getting a bag for life.
It could be about pigeons.
Could be about pigeons, yeah. Who would? That would be one for our troop stories of the Northeast in the 1950s.
Yep.
19 is Oh Dear Sylvia by Dawn French.
Ah, so she must have read Bed to You and Entwined with You.
Yeah. Yeah, it's part of her trilogy telling off popular erotica novelists. Oh dear, E.L. Wistie. And 20, how's this for a curveball? The Great Gatsby.
Oof. Well, one of these things is not like the other.
It really isn't, is it? What the hell?
See, that's like an actual book.
Yeah.
I know.
See, I'm looking at this, though, and I would have assumed that the number one book left in hotel rooms was the Gideon's Bible, but...
Yes.
Because, yeah, you know, when you get into a hotel room and you open the drawer... And there's that Bible. You go, nope.
It must have converted someone at some point. Otherwise, why would they keep doing it?
Hope is a good thing.
Religion is normally such a rational, results-based enterprise. I can't figure it out.
And writing books isn't.
God, are you saying that, like, the Bible is the Pirates of the Caribbean of books?
Yes, I am.
Look, we had one good result, so we're just going to keep putting these out.
Yep.
Now, that is, up until the end, not a good list of books, I think we agree.
Yes.
However, there's a monstrous list that has been released by Virgin Atlantic, which are the top 10 books that are left behind on Virgin Atlantic flights. And it paints passengers on Virgin Atlantic as being the most unbearable people to be trapped in a small, highly pressurized metal tube several thousand feet up in the air with.
Okay.
Number 10, which, you know, could be worse. I'm not a great fan of it, but it's The Help by Catherine Stockett.
Yeah, that's okay. That's just, you know, a popular novel.
Hmm.
Mm. 9 is An Idiot Abroad, Travel Diaries by Carl Pilkington.
I actually hate that show.
Yeah, it's like... I mean, I don't think it's a good idea for a programme anyway, but it's like they make it worse by featuring frequent cutaways to the lovely sound of Ricky Gervais's laugh.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, I hate the veiled racism in the show.
Mm.
You know.
And basically everywhere abroad is just weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are we sure it's actually people buying these books? Like, maybe it's not just Ricky Gervais buying like 100 copies and just sitting there going, God, I'm so funny.
Yes.
Because that seems exactly like something Ricky Gervais would do.
It absolutely does. And then if someone found out and got flack for it, he'd just spend all day on Twitter going, oh, you're offended, are you?
We should remake The Office, but everyone is trans.
Yes! Everyone is trans apart from one person who's a Christian and actually isn't very vocal about it and just gets on with people.
Yes, that is perfect.
That works for me.
And then as we're there, winning all the awards, we just go up, like, caress Ricky Gervais's face with her BAFTA and whisper, "Are you offended?"
Yes, 8 is Screw Business as Usual by Richard Branson.
Okay, so...
But surely, like, Virgin just buy that and put that on the plane?
It has occurred to me it is probably the Gideon's Bible of Virgin Atlantic flights.
Hang on, does that mean they're losing passengers then? They just walk onto the plane, see that on the seat and go, nope.
Yes. Yeah, it's if you don't know this, listeners, it's full of handy business tips from Richard Branson's life, such as why not sue the NHS for millions of pounds?
So are these handy business tips when you're doing your business or when you're doing business?
It is called Screw Business as Usual, so it strikes me as horribly plausible that it's Richard Branson's sex tips.
Well, also Richard Branson's toilet tips.
Oh. Tip number one. Have lots of money.
Yes.
It's good to wipe with.
Number 7 is May I Have Your Attention, Please? By James Corden.
My answer is no.
I think that is the point in which I just punch out one of the windows and jump for it.
Yeah. Number 6 is Twisting My Melon by Sean Ryder.
I've spent 20 years processing that line. Twisting my melon, and I still don't know what he's on about.
I love that Sean Ryder has a book called Twisting My Melon, but I also hate that people are actually buying and reading it.
Yes.
And just to return to the James Corden one, where he's got, "May I have your attention, please?" For some reason, now that that line's in my head, I've now got Slim Shady and James Corden is neither.
God, that would probably be something he'd do on Carpool Karaoke, wouldn't it?
Word.
Yes.
5.
I bet Ed Sheeran would be there just to make me hate it more.
Yes. 5. I admit I don't know this one. It's I Heart Vegas by Lindsay Kelk.
See, I always get confused when they do the I Heart thing, because some people can't say the word heart, and so they pronounce it hate, and that can get very confusing.
Lindsay Kelk is a ridiculous name, though. It sounds like one of the correspondents from the Day Today.
Yes!
4 is The World of Downton Abbey by Jessica Fellows.
So, hang on. The World of Downton Abbey, not Downton Abbey.
Yeah, it's the Downton Abbey extended universe.
Or maybe it's The Guide to Downton Abbey.
It is. It's like the companion book, isn't it?
So is Downton Abbey so convoluted and confusing that it actually needs a handy, helpful guide?
Yes, that's a very good point. Also wonder whether where showrunner Julian Fellowes found this Jessica Fellowes from. Must have been an endless talent search to find that writer.
Mm.
3 is Santa Baby by Katie Price.
I'm not even gonna give that a comment.
No. 2 is Glorious, My World, Football and Me by Paul Gascoigne. And number 1 is The Way I See It by Alan Sugar.
The Way I See It
is that we should burn the world. I agree, Alan.
Well, that was depressing. Shall we lighten the mood with some silly local idioms?
Yes.
Please, yes.
Absolutely, yes.
There is a quiz in The Guardian where nominated translators for the International Man Booker Award have shared their favourite sayings that are hard to translate into English. The first is a South Korean saying, which literally translates to "even a whale will dance if you compliment it." But what is this statement used to mean? There's a choice of 3. Is it A, no one is immune to flattery? B, it's hard to resist a good dance session? C, whales are famously narcissistic?
B and C are both factually accurate.
Yes. It is A, though, I think.
Yeah, it's got to be A, right?
I will click A. And that is correct.
I like this quiz.
But can you just imagine if there was an entire idiom that basically just boils down to whales? What a bunch of pricks.
Whales, am I right? A Spanish language saying used in Argentina translates as to want the sow, the 20, and the sausage-making machine, which means A, to be a remarkably indulgent carnivore, B, to want to have your cake and eat it too, C, to believe in the benefits of economic interventionism.
What was the line again?
To want the sow, the 20, and the sausage-making machine.
I mean, I guess B.
I'm thinking B as well.
But the, having the cake and eating it too is like having two things that are good. Because like obviously you want to eat the cake, but you want to have the cake. Why would you want to make the sausages?
Yes. Yeah, there is a popular English idiom that suggests you don't want to look too carefully into that. Also, having your cake and eating it always confused me when I was young, because I thought, like, well, why else would you have a cake?
To wander around and lord it over people who don't have cake?
Yeah, the Marie Antoinette solution, I guess. But yes, it does mean to want to have your cake and eat it too.
That's weird. We are uncharacteristically killing it on this quiz.
The French idiom that translates literally as put the key under the door means...
I mean, I'm going to jump the gun and say something sexy.
It does sound very sexy, doesn't it? But is it A, to quit doing something early when it doesn't seem like it's going well? B, close down a business or stop performing an activity? Or C, Andrew, a sleazy approach by an older man?
Ooh, ouch. Put the
see,
key in the...
My head says A, but my heart says C.
See, my head's saying A.
Okay, let's click A. No, in fact, it means to close a business or stop performing an activity.
So we're both wrong.
Yeah.
That's weird.
But the true right answer is, of course, a sleazy approach by an older man, because it's French.
Yes.
I think the French have just lied about what it means.
Yes.
I mean, I can just imagine a Frenchman just walking up to a woman and say, I put my key under your door, eh?
Which would be quite unnerving if it meant to pull out early because it's not going well.
Well, we've killed Rob, so I think I win by default.
I regret saying that.
You regret nothing. You knew what you were doing.
In German, there is a phrase, you're getting on my biscuit. What does that mean? Is it A, you're getting on my nerves? B, you're clumsy? C, you're a brazen snack snatcher and I hate you?
I mean, C is absolutely fabulous, but I assume it's A.
Yeah, A.
It is indeed A.
Also, my favourite German idiom is being able to describe a short person as being three cheeses high.
That's excellent.
That's,
isn't it, though?
It is.
Another French one, which I feel fairly certain we cannot make any innuendo about. This idiom is to have the cockroach. Does it mean A, to be down in the dumps or have the blues? B, to be saddled with a burden that is never likely to go away? Or C, to have a desperate need to dance every time you hear La Cucaracha?
Oh, it's got to be C. Nah.
I mean, I think if I'm being C is called just being human.
Yeah.
Right.
But surely it's B, right? Because cockroaches, they famously do not ever die.
I think A.
Let's see what it is. Rob's right, it is indeed A.
Really?
Yeah.
But why cockroach?
Who knows? This one, I think, will be slightly less challenging. But hey, I haven't clicked it yet. It could be anything. In South Korea, the phrase is to laugh until your navel falls out. Does that mean to split your sides laughing? To be punished for laughing at something cruel? Or to get fit with hilarious antics?
Oh, it's got to be C.
See, that's just an incredible idea, like an entire workout regime that is based around just the sheer amount of jogging you have to do during a classic bedroom farce. But no, I assume it's A.
It is indeed A. The Austrian saying, which when translated literally from German, reads, to speak the way one's beak grew, means A, to be a straight talker who doesn't mince words, B, to speak in the language of your home country, or C, to wet one's beak.
Or is it D, to discover that you are actually the reincarnated Prince Khufu of Egypt and also Thanagari and Qatar Hall? The Hawkman!
Wow!
Comics are great!
Oh boy.
Also, I got distracted by Hawkman and I didn't actually listen to what the options were.
A is to be a straight talker, B is to speak in the language of your home country, and C is to wet one's beak.
I'd say B.
Speak the way you be. Yeah, I guess B.
Okay. It is, in fact, A. Straight talkers speak the way one's beak grew.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that include Beaker from The Muppets?
Yes. It means that every bird is, when it seems to be tweeting in a beautiful way, is actually being quite cutting and blunt.
Yeah, I buy that.
Yeah.
They're fun over in Austria, aren't they? I can't think of an Austrian thing that hasn't filled me with joie de vivre.
I think maybe we should move on to the next question.
Yes.
Maybe we should. It's a Spanish phrase, and it translates literally as between arse and boxer shorts.
Wow! I don't know what this is about, but I love it already.
Does it mean A, to be trapped in a tricky spot? B, to feel a liberating sense of freedom? Or C, to be thick as thieves?
Oh, wow. They're all really good choices.
Yeah. Is it a trick question? There is, in fact, no wrong answer.
I'd say A, just because I think A is the correct one, but C is just... I'm still trying to work out how that would work.
I suppose if you're very, very close to someone, you might be between their arse and their boxer shorts.
I mean, what was it again?
To be trapped in a tricky spot.
I like that one best, so I want it to be true.
Let's see. It is, in fact, thick as thieves.
What?
Yes. Wow.
I'm going to start using that with all my friends.
Yeah.
We're between arse and boxes.
Oh, wow. That conjures up all sorts of images.
Doesn't it just?
You and me, we stick together like arse and boxer shorts.
Which is especially true on a hot day.
Jesus, Spain. Look, I know we'd managed to call Plankton for his whole, whoa, aren't other cultures weird?
Mm.
Other cultures are kind of weird sometimes.
They kind of are. I'm going to try pronouncing this one, by the way. Be ready. Anderharen Herbizurgen translates literally as dragged in by the hair. What does it mean to be dragged kicking and screaming? To be far-fetched? Or to be like something the cat dragged in?
Oh.
Is this Norwegian or some kind of Scandinavian?
It doesn't say, which is why I made the mistake of pronouncing it.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I'm going off what your pronunciation sounded like, which is not necessarily what it's supposed to sound.
Yeah, bad mistake, I think.
Yep. I'll be honest, it could be the kicking and screaming, but given how wrong we've been on certain ones, like the last one, I'm going to go with B.
Okay.
I would say C.
All right. Rob is correct. It's something far-fetched.
Really?
Dragged in by the hair. And finally...
I thought she was wrong because it didn't make any sense.
And finally, in Spanish, there is a phrase, to put one's hand in the fire, which means A, to do something very stupid, B, to attempt a task that is dangerous but might pay off, or C, to risk one's reputation for someone or something?
Ooh. C?
Andrew?
The potential reward of shoving your hand in the fire.
Let's see what it is. It is, in fact, to risk one's reputation.
I got it right.
Yes. I think Rob won there.
I don't think he did.
To paraphrase...
I think we all won.
Well, that was good. Should we round it off there?
Yes, yes. Let's round it off.
Yeah, we probably should finish recording at some point.
Yes. Right, so all of our shows are available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, where you'll find all sorts of other stuff. All of our other podcasts are there, reviews are there, our Patreon is there, our shop is also there. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or on Twitter, or contact us direct using studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Until next time then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Graham.
We'll see you all later.
Bye. Oh, thanks for listening. I didn't say that. Why didn't I say that? I always say that, but I didn't say it.